And when we, especially in the context when a researcher and a respondent share so much, but also have differences in the position on the situation of, it also shows how, you know, academia doesn't have to be detached from life. It actually can be also something which is an act of solidarity, of coping, of helping, and really, you know, being embedded in the social reality that you are part of. One has to admit that. One has to reflect that. It probably also has to be, it changes the way you write.
Herzlich willkommen and welcome to a new English language episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast dealing with the multiple ways in which the past matters for current affairs. I'm Gabriele Wojdelko and I will be your host for the next, let's say, approximately 45 minutes. It's February 2024 and this marks a sad anniversary. We are 2 years into the full-scale Russian war against Ukraine. On this occasion, I've spoken to Ukrainian historian Sofia Diak about the role that historians can and do take in documenting this war. Where and how can Ukrainian historians currently make a meaningful contribution, collecting testimonies about everyday life in times of occupation and armed conflict? How is it possible for them to separate between academic distance and emotional involvement? And to what kind of post-war justice can historians contribute in Ukraine while the war is still unfolding? This is what I discussed with Sofia Diak during our conversation. Sofia is the director of the Center for Urban History in Lviv in Western Ukraine. Körber Stiftung and the center have a long common history of cooperation and support. The center has been established in 2004 as an independent, privately funded research institution working for urban history research, for digital humanities, archiving, and public history. Independence, reaching out to the public and involving different communities in Ukraine and beyond, remains crucial for the center until today, also in times of war. The center's home is a beautifully restored 19th century building in Lviv, Lemberg, Lvov, Lvov, as you wish. Sofia Diak has been the director of the Center for Urban History and the head of the foundation that gives its legal framework in Ukraine since 2010. And as a historian, she specializes on post-war urban recovery and transformation in Eastern Europe. She also worked a lot on the multi-ethnic and multicultural past of Lviv in the 19th and 20th century. She curated many exhibitions and educational projects related to rethinking the past, particularly in urban public spaces. And since February 2022, Sofia Diak and her team lived through the Russian full-scale attack on their home country. The war has changed their personal lives dramatically, but it has also changed the work as historians and it has changed the institute itself. And this is what we talked about in our podcast. Sofia, we have known each other for quite a couple of years, and I've been to your institute, to the Center of Urban History in Lviv already before the full-scale invasion. Your institute is a research and a public history institution in Western Ukraine, in Lviv. And just can you tell our listeners how the full-scale invasion by Russia has changed the work of the institute and maybe the institute itself?
Thank you, Gabi, for the invitation. And indeed, you've been following the work for quite some time. This is a fairly new institution, but already with history, we'll be marking 20 years from the foundation of the center. And then thinking about how the war changed our work, it's something that you don't want to admit. You know, it's something like not on the, but still we gathered together in our conference room, all the staff, all the colleagues, there are around 25 of us, and saying, what should we do if something happens? We don't know what, how it would look. So one of our colleagues, she joined us just at that time for a year. She had an experience of evacuating in 2014. She was a financial manager, and she was really like very practical. So we need to have water. We need to pack really like things important. So what are important things for you personally, but also what are important things for the center? You have lots of documents. So let's create one folder of critical info, you know, documents, not just all documents. You know, it's addresses where who will be so that we know just in case who is there. Of course, you know, we were very much aware that we are more than 1,000 kilometers from Russia, border with Russia. So it's a difference. And then, you know, like something like that, we have to have cash, you know, as an institution, we operate with banking, with transfers, digital. But, you know, if systems will just go down, so how we do that? And of course, you know, waking up in the morning, it was Thursday, was first thing that we knew that you have to pay attention to your closest one. You don't go to work. You actually think about your family, your relatives. But it was really like the next day, you know, I went to work and few colleagues who agreed it would be. And then others came and we basically, so there was no weekend. So like Friday and then Saturday and Sunday. And it was immediately clear there would be a wave of refugees, of people moving west. So there was, and so it, our lives was changing radically while we were staying in the same place, in our homes, in our building. And many people, you know, like one of the decisions that we were making, and is the same did other institutions, which have space like conference room, we have guest apartments, we have shower in the office, because that's a transformed, I mean, this details do matter, because, you know, from that you can transform and act on what you can do. So we could order mattresses because we had cash. It was easier to procure than, you know, to pay it. So then there were volunteers. So we organized sleeping places in our conference room and in cafe, because we also have cafe. So there's, I mean, you can, you know, you don't operate cafe in the time then people are coming and searching for place to stay. And the first night there were like few people. We thought, okay, so how it's going to be? Like two people came to sleep over weekend. And then it was like the full room and people were coming, and because the on the railway station and there was a network and people were, we placed the information in the hub, spreading the contacts of hostels or place to stay. And this part of the center was a shelter for almost half a year. So we really shared our space, and the around 400 people stayed. And it was also not only about just giving a place to sleep, but, you know, also distributing food with cooperation with other volunteers. And then we needed also psychological help. So this the whole change of operation, and in terms of space and time and what you do. So the building stayed on facade the same. It's an early 20th century building, apartment house, historically, a house which actually survived two world wars.
Now that we are, unfortunately, almost, we are recording this podcast
in February 2024, which means we are almost 2 years into the full-scale war that Russia launched against Ukraine. And I assume that there still is, I mean, the life of you and your team and of the institution is still very different from it used, from what it used to be before February 22. Could you try to shortly describe how, where you are now, 2 years after the invasion with the institution? For sure, you are not back to normal. Of course, you are not. But the emergency phase, I think, might be over. But how do you, how have you adapted, if that is possible at all, to the situation now, 2 years into the war?
Something that very much started with the emergency was documentation. And we will probably come back to that a bit later. But the several projects and initiatives that we launched as historians, sociologists, were already some for 2 years. So their dynamic changed. And of course, the very act of doing documentation changed our program. So it was not something radically new, because we have archive, you know what archiving means. We work with oral history, so we kind of tapped into our capacity and expertise. But that was something very new, how you as a researcher is also in the position of somebody who experiences the same time. So you do have this overlap of roles and positions. So we had to rethink how we can continue our mission, but also change it and make it relevant. And probably something that was very critical is to have a conversation what makes sense, because things to have make sense in general, but in the context of danger, in the context of exhaustion, it's 2 years. So it's, of limited resources, you know, physically and attention wise, you have to, things have to make sense. And you have to really ask yourself and talk with colleagues, why are we doing this? And then, you know, there is also something that the center was very, for the center from the very beginning was important to be the place of bringing together scholars from different places and countries. And in 2022, mostly journalists were coming. We never had so many journalists in our lives. and fewer scholars, really fewer, much fewer. So, because it's also about, you know, safety and also the regulations of research institutions, which do not, you know, not always fund and still don't fund research trips to Ukraine in many cases. But so we reoriented also our understanding, which part of our professional community needs help. So our fellowships and residences programs was reoriented mostly to people and colleagues in Ukraine. So also in cooperation with Kerber, we were able to offer fellowships with stipends. It was really critical for people who could not leave. You know, there were many programs for scholars at risk abroad, but not everybody can want leave. You know, that's, and as it's relatively safe a part of Ukraine and there is institutional infrastructure, it was important to offer the staying residences at the center so that people can continue their work in, or find the ways to continue their work, because it also gives dignity, it also gives resilience, it gives agency. And then finally, you know, it's something that, you know, how you plan, but at the same time, you're very open to change these plans, to adapt them. To my colleagues have their loved ones, partners serving in cold and mobilized to the army. So male colleagues can be mobilized and you actually plan to think how work can continue. It will change how you react. So this is a daily, it's a daily operation. But on the same time, you know, this year, last year, 2023, we saw that our public program, lectures, presentations, audience, people coming. We think a lot, usually, and especially now, what topics we propose, how we talk, what makes sense again. But the number of people who come, the number of events that we have actually came back even to pre-COVID level. So it's also rebounding in a different way, but quite dynamically and strongly.
Oh, that's interesting, because we are hearing this a lot and reading this a lot also here in Germany and in other parts of Europe, I guess, that there is this strive for a sense of normality in times of war in Ukraine, and people want to go out, people want to attend events, people want to celebrate their birthdays with their loved ones. Of course they do. So this normality in times of war is a particular issue. Sophia, I'd like to come back to the documentation. You mentioned that you thought carefully about what your contribution as a historical institute, as an institute of historical research, can be in terms of documenting this war. I mean, the current war is considered to be very well documented by bloggers, by journalists, but also via social media, by ordinary citizens. There are a lot of pictures, a lot of stories from this war. Refugees are talking about their experiences, also here in Germany, of course, because we are hosting war refugees from Ukraine since the very early days of the full-scale invasion. What do you think, what can this, let's say, historical documentation add to the other narratives about the public narratives about this war? What is the particular aspect of your documentation?
This is each new war is the most documented war, right? So, and we do hope that this war will be the last most documented war.
We keep our fingers crossed, yes.
We keep our fingers crossed for that. And it also, you know, this most documented reflects awareness of people and professionals in different capacities, but also people who are not journalists, who are not historians, and the sense that this is a historical moment. This acute awareness comes with, you know, radical experience. War is one of those. Revolution is another. So I was recently reading a book by Christopher Clark, who wrote a book about World War One, but his newest one is on revolutions of 1848. And, you know, that how many he describes, I mean, he said how many people like wanted to leave the record, like they're very aware of themselves living in a historical moment. So this is not like a new, it's a part of our human condition and human lives. See, but now technology's changed and people are literate. You know, these people do write, know how to write. So there's a lot of also self-documentation and readiness of people. In all of the wealthness of the documentation, that was a challenge for us to think, A, what we can do, but also what we can do quite quickly. Because I think that the meeting we had about our document, what we do professionally, except of what we do as humans by offering our space, but also what we do professionally. So it was literally in the basement because air raids were really, really very frequent. And we were sitting and spending time in the basement, which is part of office space, also comfortable. To be sure, we were also in privileged position to be able to think about. So it was on, I think, Tuesday, 5 days. And we started very immediately, One of my colleagues, Bohdan Shumilovich, had a class of students and they were going nuts. We thought, you know, he suggested, let's me work with them so that they would write diaries and we would talk. Yeah. So it also would help psychologically, therapeutically. So started the project called Diaries of War, which gradually moved into the dreams. So it's very niche thing, quite interesting, very challenging. We work with this topic of dreams and the night experiences. So again, so like looking into like parts which might not be covered in journalism or not covered in, I mean, might later be really telling and not that frequent. Then the option, the second was direction that we followed was in testimonies, because oral history is one of the area where we work. We have archive, and it also, we did have an experience of emergency reaction. So not a project that you plan, apply, receive funding, and then go, you know, get feedback and you go on. Then Maidan started. Actually, we're again in this position of participants and researchers.
You mean the first or the second Maidan?
The second, 2013. You know, so we did interviewing people on the squares in Lviv, Kyiv, Kharkiv as it was happening. So it's early. So we have from early December 13, and then in February before the shooting. So it's really very early. And a lot of thinking went afterwards. We thought, okay, we actually could think about testimonies, but we need to like proceed very carefully. And in coming 6 months, what we did, and the project led by Natalia, was, I mean, gathered scholars in Ukraine, but also established network of scholars in Europe. And because, as you said, you know, refugees and people displaced were moving. So we caught people in the moment of transition. And in this first 5 months, like between end of March until beginning of September, around 150 interviews, long interviews, biographical interviews, and I will come back to that moment, were collected, recorded, and people were asked if they would agree for the second conversation. This was important as a marker how they felt from this experience, you know, of sharing their stories and their traumatic stories, but also like trying to see if you would talk with them after the end of the war. So it also was this hope, the shock of war was together with the hope that it would end sooner. So we will have the second round of talking with our first respondents this year. So we are still in the midst of war, but it also like methodologically like follows people. And we want to have these life stories, which are not quick record of what happened now, but rather understanding the war in a longer trajectory of human life and how different factors come into decisions and experiences. So this is actually what, you know, historical documentation is different than from journalist reporting or taking. It's a different temporality that we work with in a way.
That's very interesting, because on the one hand, you said you could build on the experiences you made at the Revolution of Dignity. And then you had your professional expertise as historians who are very, very indeed experienced in doing and working with oral history. And you describe, you talked about temporality, you talked about, let's say, the long-term perspective that you are able to take as historians to interview people again, not just do a one and off conversation, but to follow them more closely. How do people react when you ask to stay in touch and to be interviewed again? Because I can assume that it's very difficult to predict for them where they are, where they will be, let's say, in 6 months. Is it, Line, do you have in general a very positive feedback? Do people really want to talk and continue talking?
Yeah, so that was the experience of 2022. It was important that the conversation was in person. So most of the interviews were done in person. So, and this human bond happens, right? So not 100%, but like really overwhelmingly close, you know, left the contact and agreement. So we will have to follow that. It will be a challenge because some left emails, phones could change. Probably they did not because people keep old phones to stay in touch. And so we are aware that probably we will not manage to find like all 150 people. But even if you would locate part of, you know, and reconnect with a part, that would be critically, I think, critically important for building this longer narrative of the personal dimension of the big war, which is a big political, historical event. And also something that the temporality works in the moment of releasing, because people have the choice to say that then they want to. It's not the interview that you find next day in the newspaper. So it's a different one. And with all the precaution on private information, you know, sensitive information that one find, because it's the process of archiving this, and also the right, the people have the right to withdraw their interviews. I think that this is very important for the team working, that the ultimate power has to be with a person sharing his or her story. So it's this empowering moment, not only for telling your experience and being listened to, but also having the right to your story. So the second meeting also might be the result that people say, okay, take my interview out of the archive, and one has to live with that. So we actually like to think, it's a point very important for oral history. As a format, it is also a part of democracy, right? So it's kind of, we work with the assumption that of human dignity, of rights, of privacy, of voice, of respect. So this is, and, you know, we do work, like walk a thin line, taking this responsibility, because we do not know what the future will be. We don't know. So we do hope that the war will be over, and that this will be not occupied country, but democratic country, right?
With the interviews you are doing, you are producing historical sources for the future, for a future about which you do not know what it's going to be like. We, of course, keep all our fingers crossed that Ukraine will win, and that it's going to be a non-occupied country, and it's going to be democratic. So my question with regard to the materials you produce, to what extent are they, let's say, historical sources for the future, in quotation marks only, or to what extent might they also be useful to achieve or to re-achieve justice for the people of Ukraine who suffered from the Russian aggression? I mean, to put it very clearly, we all hope there are going to be court hearings. We all hope that, you know, this question of justice will come up. And the question is, when will it come up? And what are the materials to be used? Can you contribute with your interviews to that as well?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's, you know, to begin, that the work done by historians, perspective of this future writing of history, is different than how war crimes are documented for court cases. These are really different things. Doesn't mean that they are not connected. Doesn't mean that there is no conversation or like flow of the expertise around, but this is really a difference. You know, this court cases documentation is done with the specific protocol, as, you know, oral history has its protocol. You know, how do you do that? However, you know, I mean, one can definitely think that these sources could be important for context. That could be. If you think strictly about justice as something that takes place in the courtroom. But we also might think that justice takes place in many ways and not only in a courtroom. And I think for that, such testimonies are really important because just storytelling and sharing story is a part of justice working, you know, like in a way that was the first, like giving. So it's not giving the, like we were on the same side and talking. So it's not justice through punishment. It's justice which through acknowledgement. And the question that after the war, justice takes really years to come. So this is not a short process, neither for the courtrooms. I mean, we know that from the last war, courts were happening for all the 40s, then, I mean, depending which country in Europe.
Exactly. You were talking about the Second World War now.
The Second World War. Like, so this is really like, you know, we know that the biggest trial, Eichmann trial, happens in 60s, right? So it's really, it's a long, we do not know what will be the temporality, but also the history, for example, of post-apartheid South Africa tells how important it is to have voice, to voice your experience, to, and, you know, telling the story of war from various perspectives, not only military, but civilian, different civilian experiences, and finding your story included, or your experience included, maybe not literally as your voice, but as something that somebody else voiced, is a part of, you know, having, you know, justice in a much broader and not legally. But to be sure, like for the legal perspective is critical. You know, it's really very hard to imagine. It's very hard to move on without like having this legal process where the state, which is aggressor state, goes unpunished. You know, punishment and goes without reckoning. But I think that this will be really a component, a very like part of society, Ukrainian society, moving away from the war while telling the stories of war. And here, I think we will need these sources.
This brings me to an issue that I feel, or I felt almost for the whole time of our conversation. You are talking to me and to our audience as a professional historian, as a director of a research institution. You are talking about your, let's say, new roles as historians, some of which are new, some aspects are not as new as, because you described that you had previous experiences with, but still, how difficult or how challenging is it to balance the academic standards, let's say, with regard to oral history and interviewing and producing sources and thinking and writing about justice? I mean, this is something you as a historian and you as historians know, and you are very well equipped to do that. But how difficult it is to balance these academic standards with your very personal, emotional involvement in this war, not only you personally, but that goes for your whole team. I imagine that this must be very challenging.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a subject of conversations that we do have, right? So formally, then we have our seminars. Informally, then we have a, you know, cup of coffee or tea. And I think that, you know, that's this professional and personal navigating, you know, ratio, intellectual and emotional. I mean, we do operate with them as different, sometimes contradicting each other or have to be absent from one. But I think that, you know, we also, like recent historiography of couple decades, probably, said us that, you know, this is rethinking the division and separation and making us aware of how academic work is connected to our positionality. I think that we also, you know, borrow that from, I mean, gender studies. Very much, you know, one could tap into that discussion. Also, you know, for all the post-colonial theory, it's very much, you know, make one aware that, you know, that academic does not mean not biased. You have to be very aware of oneself. And I think that war in this liminal situation makes many things more apparent, more visible, and kind of also pushes you to question the basics. Like, not question them in the way of undermining or shattering, but rather like, you know, like thinking again, like thinking through what does it mean? So what does it mean to be a historian? What does it mean to be? And so I think that, you know, this acknowledging emotional in academic research and actually also working with emotional parts and in academic research is something that is already in the professional discussion, to put it this way. And when we, especially in the context when a researcher and a respondent share so much, while also have differences in the position on the situation of, it also shows how, you know, academia doesn't have to be detached from life. It actually can be also something which is an act of solidarity, of coping, of helping, and really, you know, being embedded in the social reality that you are part of. One has to admit that. One has to reflect that. It probably also has to be, it changes the way you write. So the text, it can be, and I think that we also do have this already precedence in the writing of history where we navigate that here is something that we have from archive, here we have from there, here is a something that we interpret and might be much more shaky and more uncertain. And all the history from below, also the history of subaltern, provides the tools for doing that. So, but coming back to emotions, you know, you had emotions are critical part in understanding war and going through war.
Thank you, because your answer gave a much clearer picture that, you know, how difficult it is to separate academia and ratio and emotions, and that maybe it's not even always necessary. I'd like to ask you about historical contexts, because, you know, very often when we talk about the current Russian war against Ukraine, very often we use the phrase, it's unprecedented, it's unprecedented brutality, unprecedented different aspects, but you know, the word has been used very, very often. And I remember shortly after the full scale invasion, I think it was March 22, the two of us had a conversation, and I asked you how you feel about the invasion and what it reminds you of. And you said, I'm thinking a lot about Lviv in 1939 these days. And so my question is, which contexts of Second World War Ukraine, of Second World War Lviv, of occupation, of extermination, which historical contexts do you think are most relevant to understand or to contextualize the current Russian war?
Yeah, that's a huge question. And I think, you know, World War II is the closest big war we have. But at the same time, when we say that it's unprecedented, because for quite a long time in Europe, we didn't have war.
I guess the people of former Yugoslavia
It's like, you know, it's even like, you know, this is like the 20 years. We did not actively and And it's very right, you know, that rough further away war doesn't mean that the world didn't have war. There were wars. But in Ukraine, that's the latest experience is the World War II. But in the lifetime, it's like the first, right, that you experience. And, you know, like there were these phrases from the, you know, remember from the 80s into the 90s that people, older generation would like sometimes say, we wish you a peaceful sky over your head. And just kind of, you would not understand this was like a phrase, like kind of now it does really resonate very poignantly. So it's, you know, I think that the biggest one of the, it's about the scale of destruction. It's not yet as huge as in the last for Ukraine big war, which was the Second World War, and the scale of occupation. So the whole territory of Ukraine was the war theater battle-wise. So you have to think that in Eastern Front, from former Soviet Union, like two Soviet republics, if you think Belarus and Ukraine, were devastated by the war and by occupation. Like each city, each town, each village, you just go. And I think that this is also something that probably distinguishes the memory of the war from the an experience of war from the Soviet Russia, which was not, which was only partly, you know, in the Leningrad, you know, this. So it's this experience of war is different. So this the question of you know, destruction and then resilience, you know, that you see how many places were rebuilt. Another is probably is occupation. So the whole of territory of Ukraine was under different zones, but occupied by Nazi Germany. And in the post-war, we have this like lesson and legacy that how poorly and wrongly that was done and dealt with. So people could not be, people were tainted by being at the occupation. People were, you know, had to write. And I think that this is also something that we need to really consider in the way we are already now like proceeding and thinking about people and territories which experienced occupation. You know, how to have wisdom and how to have understanding and how to have sensitivity and caution. And I think it is also happening. So I can also see that it was not a part of World War II experience, which was very much, it was dealt with, but not that much. It takes time to deal with, to research, to discuss, and how it probably will be part of the future as well. You know, how going through this war will make us think in a different way or ask questions and look for the previous one. And I think that this in to another direction is the attention to the civilians, right? So and the way you will write military history that we will probably, you know, see later. There's so much information will be later available than now. But, you know, how to grasp this and the intensity and diversity of what is war, because it encompasses all parts of life. And this also bounces back to the question of where do you look? So I think historians can, like those working especially with World War II and occupation, World War I, could that kind of suggest where one could look to create sources? Because when you go to archive, or you know that you find, and you also know what you don't find. So you would, like, to give you like an example. So we moved one of our focuses of also oral history. There are other projects, but with oral history is asking professionals. Infrastructure is very important, but we do learn about infrastructure through different types of sources. It would be really are missing it from the World War II period. You know, what does it mean to be a plumber? What does it mean to be a first responder? So people who work with as critical, essential infrastructure and do the work. So that people who have voice are not only people who are writers or people of culture, but also people who usually don't have voice, usually, you know, in the statistics. And I think statistics is important for history and for understanding our society, but we need also qualitative. And then finally, when we will come back, it's a question of justice again, you know, so because all the system of post-war justice, we are tracing back to the World War II. You know, when we were talking in March, you know, 22, you know, there were like conversation that we had and about past war, but also changed over the last 2 years that it seems that there is, while there's a sense of exhaustion and emotional and physical, there's also more interest to this. You already see. So before 22, we were planning a project about Lviv ghetto and we put it on hold for a year and a half. It's a very difficult topic to study. So you have to be ready or capable. And we unshelved it last year gradually. And yesterday we had a lecture. We invited a scholar from Warsaw working with a collection of drawings of a teenager boy who did not survive Holocaust in Lviv. But he left hundreds of drawings. And there was a full room. So people came. You see that the topics do resonate. And this is the way that we learn not only about the past, but also about ourselves. And I think that there is a chance that we will revisit World War II history again, and generally histories of war, how we do right. I mean, the Second World War is just simply, you know, the biggest and so far for this country.
Thank you so much, Sophia. Revisiting the war, revisiting the way you as historians write about war. I know that historians are very reluctant to talk about the future, but my final question to you for this podcast is, as a professional historian, as a citizen of Lviv, of Ukraine, what gives you hope for the future? And what can we do, let's say, we as Germans, we as colleagues, to help you maintaining this hope?
You know, history teaches us that after very dark times comes light. The price might be awful and not everybody gets to see the light because, you know, people are, you know, killed, and we are, as we speak. The 20th century gives like the buff, the sense that there is a huge, depthness, abyss of destruction and what people can do to each other. But there is also like a story of resilience and recovery. You know, I worked with the post-war. I'm not one of the brave historians who can work on the violence immediately, you know, after. And like thinking that how many people managed to reassemble their life in some way, how people continued living by being still disfigured emotionally and physically, it kind of gives a lot of pain because, you know, I don't understand that I will live my life people who went through this war will live life in the post-war. And it's also very frightening to know that it was really like the 70s and the 80s that the people who were without limbs, you know, it was like really into the 80s that even from the streets of Ukrainian cities, but actually to other cities in Europe, people who were disfigured because they died, you know, because of age, those who were. So, and you do see that this is something, the future, that will be society which is very transformed in so many levels. We don't know which and way, but we already see that that's. And I think that it's a question of seeing that this is not happening to somebody else, but it's a kind of something that happens and transforms not only Ukraine, but the world. I mean, definitely does transform what Europe is, what European is. And it's a very scary realization that world is not going to be the same. It comes and probably, you know, it was shown and a great support. And I think that everybody in Ukraine is really extremely aware of how this support matters. There is the question of, you know, how long, how much, how, you know, staying in this and holding. And it's not easy, you know. And I think like acknowledging that this is not an easy and war takes toll. But to get to the other side of this war, to get to the side of peace, I think that it's important to see that there are no other option. One has to make everything possible to end the war and be aware that we will be all changed by that, you know, whether we are in Ukraine or we are not.
This was our History and Politics podcast episode with Sofia Diak on roles and responsibilities of Ukrainian historians 2 years into Russia's full-scale attack against Ukraine. If you are interested in the work of Sofia Diak and the Center for Urban History, we've put some information in the show notes for you. You can also donate to the center directly via the website of the Center for Urban History. If you would like to listen to other English language episodes of our podcast, just scroll down in your podcatcher and you'll easily find a couple of episodes in English, either as part of our special series, The New Germany, that deals with the implication of Zeitenwende for Germany, or some other relevant topics about the past reflected in the present that we discussed with English-speaking guests. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our podcast, we'd be happy if you subscribe to it, if you haven't done that already anyway, of course. We'd also be happy if you'd recommend us to others. If you are interested in the other work that we do at our History and Politics department, please check out our website at koerber-stiftung.de. Stay tuned, all the best, and goodbye from Hamburg.